Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we'll be looking at how editors, not creators, are often the ones who help shape our understanding of history. Curator Naya Yakamaki will be joining us later to discuss the Whitechapel Gallery's new show, Killed Negatives.
We'll also be learning the story of quintessential krautrock music experimentalists Can. Rob Young, co-author of a new book about the band called All Gates Open, will be explaining all later on.
And we'll meet film director Michelle Hasnovicius, the Oscar-winning talent behind The Artist, will be discussing his new film, Redoubtable, at the end of the programme.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be taking a look at next week's news, and we'll play some great music too, all coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hi, Tom.
Rob.
It's been quite a nice week here in London. The sun's been shining, although there has been a north wind. Photo London's
crisp
on, and all of its kind of all of its sort of attendant fanfare, which has been pretty cool down at Somerset House.
And we have a nice focus.
Been good stuff.
If you'll forgive the pun, a nice focus on a really compelling photographic exhibition a bit later in the programme.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to speaking to
Naya. Shall we? What would we put on the end of a bamboo cane?
How would I lure Fernando? I'd go two
VIP tickets to the Eurovision Song.
Well, I was going to say, on that theme, the stuff of sort of fables, legends, the siren song, but it would have to be Madonna.
Yeah.
That would, you could coax him to walk across hot coals, as I understand it.
I think so. There was something in the air.
Singing and clapping. There's a party started in studio.
There is a party started. It's a one-man party starter. Hi, Faye.
Hello.
Happy Sunday to you.
Happy Sunday. Good morning. Good afternoon.
What great theme tune you've got.
I love that song.
It's such a good song.
And it's funny. It's not only because it has my name in it, but, you know, it's just a wonderful song. And I think it does talk about war and other issues as well. My first story, actually, it is a country. I don't know if I should say this, but I do love the name of the country. It's Venezuela. You know, there's some countries that I just love naming, like, for example, Argentina. Venezuela is one of them as well. But let's be serious for a second. They are actually voting for their new president this Sunday, today. Mm-hmm. But there's been quite a few problems in the election this year. You know, first of all, Maduro will win. And the main reason for that is that the main opposition is boycotting this election. And I wonder if this is a wise decision, because, of course, there's a lot of irregularities in the whole election. You know, a lot of countries saying they will not accept it. But okay, even if it's going to be an irregular election, I think just the fact that the opposition is there on the ballot box, I think that will be important. So I think a lot of Venezuelans will be at home, and, you know, there are other candidates, but they're like independent, they're not strong enough, you know, to beat Maduro. So I feel quite sad. There's been a few protests in Caracas, but yeah, unfortunately, it's one of those elections. It's a non-election because we know that Maduro is going to win, and I don't think it will fix any of the problems of the country as well.
But there's something in what you say, Faye. Even if the process is flawed, one of the things you need to start to move those processes forward, even in a country facing the problems that are so stark and immediate as Venezuela, is participation, even if it's kind of futile.
Exactly. Remember in 2013, the date of the last election, Capriles, the main opposition guy, got 49.1% of the vote. It almost reached Maduro's 50.6%. So, and I have a feeling if there was a proper, like, strong main opposition, they would win beating Maduro.
Okay, so that was the first item. What's number two?
Well, don't worry. I think topics two and three will be much lighter. I think number two is something that we at Monaco we will cover. We will send a team there to Venice. It's the year of the architecture biennale in Venice. Very important for the world of architecture. And this year there are two curators, Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara. They're very renowned Irish architects from Grafton Architects. And they every year they have a theme. And this year the theme is free space, which is quite interesting. I know you can think of a lot of things, but, you know, basically it's architecture for everyone. You don't need to kind of be wealthy to enjoy good architecture, you know, so it's all about the free spaces. And the most interesting bit is always the national pavilions. So there's 65 countries. There's quite a lot of newcomers as well. We have Antigua and Barbuda, Guatemala, the Vatican, Lebanon, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia.
And there, I mean, this is great. The Giardini there. I've been a few times to the art
Biennale, the art section of it. And that's so lovely. It's something, I mean, it's Venice, it's crazy, it's too crowded, all the rest of it. But this is a strangely kind of nice time to go, because the part, it kind of, it hitches up its skirt, shows a bit of leg, and there are some fantastic parties to go to. It's all a bit monstrous, but the Giardini is always, no matter how crowded it is, it seems to kind of, there's light and shade and kind of beautiful buildings, and it's such a kind of, and that obviously is an architectural masterclass as well, because it's very modernist. I think the Scandinavian Pavilion is typically very modernist, and the British Pavilion is an old tea house, and the French one is grand. So it's all super cool. It's such a lovely, such a good place to visit, and kind of a nice week for it.
Well, the opening will be Saturday, 26th yeah. of May, and of course, if you don't have time to go now, I mean, we open until the 25th of November, so I'll be sure to check it out as well.
And our team will be reporting, even from as early Thursday, you know, a bit of preview actually.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to hear
it's an
more.
Exclusive.
Exactly. Hear more on the airwaves, Monaco 24.
So who have we got there? We've got Nolan and Josh is going, and they're reporting for the radio.
And I think Andrew and Tyler are going to be stopping by. So quite the Monaco delegation. I think Yara is maybe there as well.
What a posse.
Big old team. Imagine them out on the tiles.
But we have an even more important event as the third topic.
Okay.
I mean, it is a bit of a joke, but it is it is the Mr. Gay World. It used to be Mr. Gay International, but I think it didn't work out, so they decided to change the name recently.
Right.
But the thing here, of course, I don't think it's such a relevant event, but I want to talk about the decline of those type of competitions, being Miss Gay World or, you know, Miss UK or Miss Brazil, Miss Universe. It's funny because I remember, you know, even in the 90s a little bit, those events were very important. I remember in Brazil they used to be shown on primetime TV, but
because it's hardly even reported in the papers anymore, or if it's reported, it's always reported in a critical, this be banned kind of thing.
Can you believe this is still happening?
But, you know, the good thing about Mr. Gay World, I think they like to choose, men from countries that don't have a very good record on LGBT issues. So, for example, we have someone from Ethiopia, from Nepal. And, you know, so I think they want to, you know, to say, hey, these countries, they have a terrible record, but, you know, here's
a
representative.
In South Africa, you said, because South Africa itself, not
I was say, that's
fantastic.
Not-
Well,
yeah.
it's not fantastic, but I think in Africa they're certainly one of the most progressive. I believe you have gay marriage there. There's quite a lot of homophobia and violence, but in terms of the rights itself, I think they're actually quite progressive in a way. I have three favorites, actually. I think Mr. Germany, Nepal, and New Zealand.
Mr. Germany,
go for
Mr.
It.
Nepal, and Mr. New Zealand.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll be cheering for them.
Thanks, Faye.
Great photography helps shape our sense of historic narrative, but it's often less than well-known names that get the final call on the edit.
London's Whitechapel Gallery is showcasing a fairly extreme incarnation of the overzealous editor, one Roy E. Stryker, in 1930s Depression-era America, in its new exhibition, Killed Negatives, which opened this week. In it, Stryker's uninvited handiwork is across the images of photography greats ranging from Dorothea Lange to Walker Evans, for a show that's as much about what you can't see as what you can.
We're joined by the exhibition's curator, Naya Yakumaki, to tell us more. Welcome to the Monaco Weekly, Naya. Wonderful to have you with us. Perhaps, first of all, you can explain exactly what the photographs are that feature in the exhibition, because they look, at first glance, like classic documentary photography of the era, the sort of 30s and early 40s, but double take, and there's something not quite right, or is it? Tell us what they are.
Thank you for inviting me. Yes, you're absolutely right. Those photographs were traditional, or were meant to be traditional, black and white photo documentary photographs. Now look really mesmerizing and strange to us, as when we look at them, we realize that there's a black disc hovering on certain parts of the picture in all of them. What is this? Is it a contemporary art approach? Is it a conceptual artwork? Or could it be a ruthless act of censorship that in the 1930s, Roy Stryker, the director of information division of the Farm Security Administration, did?
The Farm Security Administration.
Absolutely. That's, this was the FSA.
Do we understand, and I guess the exhibition picks at this a little, what was his rationale, both for doing the editing and then how he did make his edits?
Well, we think, first of all, he might have been under lots of pressure to deliver a very particular project for the FSA, but also to the American public, which had really to show that the FSA, the Farm Security Administration, was helping the farmers recover from the condition that they were into because of the financial crisis. 1930s, the project started in 35 and finished around 44. So that was one mission. They had to record the financial assistance that FSA gave. Right. And they had to show that the farmers were benefiting from that. And the other reason was that they had to really bring back some hope, I think, to the American public. So his motives for censoring were really because the aims were very specific. They couldn't show maybe too much poverty or too much health. They were following particular scripts, shooting scripts. Every photographer had to abide by them. However, you know, they tried to be much more creative, of course. They
were... It's such a great treasure trove of photographs to have and to curate, I guess. It's such a wonderful idea. It's something we kind of, we know exists in probably every country. We know it existed in the States. I kind of tend to associate it with the kind of communist, the anti-communist 1950s and stuff especially. But this seems like such a sort of Soviet, such a dictatorial way to commission and then edit a set of photographs. It's a, such an unusual thing. There's one poor dude here with his straw hat on standing outside his farmstead, I suppose, and his whole face has simply been hole punched out or been deleted. And there's one here of two men sitting at a table. One's got his head in his hand, so it's a picture of maybe sadness and depression. Maybe this was censored because the other man's comb over is so extreme. I don't know. What do you think, Nye?
I think there were many reasons, and we could be here forever playing with each
photograph.
But
you must come up with, you must have a wonderful sense, you and your colleagues at Whitechapel must have a sense of the story behind the story here.
I think I do, but yeah. At the same time, there is also one reason that because they were not selected, they had to be destroyed,
yeah.
Which includes everything else that wasn't selected. And how many can you select from thousands of negatives that come back to you? So this is the interesting point, not just the editorial process and why they were editing, because we speculated hundreds of reasons, too good, too bad, technically wrong. But it was that they wanted to have total control of the final product. So if they chose five, the 995 of the 1,000 had to be destroyed. And so they maybe were worrying that it would go to the hands of more left sort of publications in the future, or the photographer would use them in any other way. Some of them look perfectly fine to us, and actually they're very good shots,
yeah.
Very powerful shots, but they had to be destroyed. This one that you picked with the farmer looking desperate, having his hands on the desk of a very stiff suit and tie guy who's an FSA representative, is a staged photograph. So within those approaches, there were many staged photographs. And of course, we know that from the titling. There were no formal titles. Everything was called untitled, because why should you title a reject? But the photographers made notes. And this was a desperate farmer worrying about his debts. So they had to show he was desperate.
Have you seen the kind of instructions that were given to the photographers before they went out on the road?
Absolutely. So in the exhibition, we have the censored images, well, a selection of them. We have some of the correspondence between the FSA and the photographers, quite tense and heated debate sometimes. But we also have the formal documentation that they will get. So their case study for each individual that they will shoot, they would know the background of that person, their financial condition, their family situation, if their wife had left them or not. They'd know everything about that person. And also, they would have a shooting script. They have about 20 instructions or 20 shots from every photographer that they want back. And the first is always depict poverty. So not in the exact words, but show farm, poor children, tattered clothes. And the final is back at farm, everyone happy. They had to deliver a happy end.
Rob and I were talking before, in particular, about this image,
love
which
this.
Is
yeah.
of a sort
it.
Of a collapsed building, and again, the disc central. And Rob said to me, that picture would be less were it not for the disc. And I guess if you look back to the more experimental artists, photographers, people were playing cross mediums at that time in the sort of 30s and into the early 40s, you had, you know, your sort of René Magritte or whoever it might be, adding just simple discs of colour, obscuring this obvious themes. It looks like a quintessentially conceptual piece from that era. It's extraordinary that it's been achieved inadvertently.
Of course, to play with the word spot on, these were exactly my thoughts for putting the show up, that at the same time, this is one of my favorite images as well. This is a house that's about to collapse. We can see the landscape is full of water because we know that areas were destroyed by floods, so that didn't help the farmers. And then you have this wonderful play between the tilted house and the black dot.
Yeah.
And the reason that the exhibition is inside a contemporary art gallery, such as the Whitechapel Gallery, is because there are two layers in our understanding of these images. One, of course, is the historical aspect, the censorship, the unknown. And the other is that as contemporary viewers, we cannot disassociate that from conceptual art, abstract art, from romanticizing them and making them look beautiful in our heads. And I think this is the important play. That's why we invited contemporary artists as well, the work of contemporary artists who were initially interested in the killed negatives years before you know, these were known to the public.
Where have they been? These meant to be destroyed, not destroyed, reject images that are so serendipitous and so beautiful and improved upon no end by having these strange kind of interventions in them. Where did you find them?
So we looked at various sources. The majority of material are at the Library of Congress.
Okay.
In the US, because that's where all the FSA documents went, including the selected ones and the rejected ones, and all the documentation letters and all the other documents I mentioned before. So they have a huge body of material there. Only very recently, they decided to digitize the killed negatives. Killed is also a description that the Roy Stryker used. So we have documents where you see a document going killed, killed, killed. So the killed negatives, they digitized them. So for the first time, they were visible to the archivists. So we worked with them at the Library of Congress. We worked with the Smithsonian Institution, who hold the papers of Ben Shawn, one of the photographers, with the Metropolitan Museum in New York, who hold the Walker Evans diaries and Walker Evans estate, and the contemporary artists' galleries. So, yeah, the majority is at the Library of Congress, but in a way, parts of that history are everywhere. And I hope with the exhibition now, more things can start to come to light.
There are so many discussions about the veracity of photography, whether it's reportage, whether it's... There are so many discussions around this. And this is a very rich seam, I suppose, that your show explores. The idea of just because it's been shot and it's real life doesn't mean it happened or something like that, right?
Yes. And also, I think, mentioning the importance of photography and the knowledge we have of photographic history, I don't think we can go back and look at the formal history of photography as we know it, with Walker Evans, Dorothea Lange and Karl Maidens doing these beautiful, powerful portraits of the farmers. We can't look at it in the same way again. When we have the shooting scripts in our hands, when we know that they were instructed, when we know that they hated the job many times. And so I think if you were to teach history of photography again, after the exhibition in a way, or after the research, you would teach it very differently.
And also I wonder what the subjects thought of being shot in their homes, looking happy, sad, whatever, and then being asked to just move a bit to the left. And can you just scrunch your face up a little bit more and look a bit sadder or happier? Or it's very deliberate, isn't it?
Yeah, the photographic job in that sense must have been very difficult, because we know from the notes that the photographers kept in their own notebooks that what they were looking at was very, very deprived people. Dorothea Lange, who didn't have any of her negatives killed, she describes the family of five starving children who, every visit she went, they were only eating green raw onions. And she was saying that's all they had. So you can imagine, as a photographer, having this and then being asked to depict this family with a happy end in the end. So I think a very, very complicated situation for an artist to have to deliver. That's why a lot of them were in great tension with Roy Stryker. Some left. But the letters really depict that tension. They were trying to do, within that restriction, though, I'm amazed that they tried to do their own thing, and they had a very interesting approach. The majority of the photographers did shoot what they want, and a lot of them are censored, of course.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned Stryker again at the end there. I mean, is he the hero or the villain of the piece? Because it's interesting to say, look, these must be destroyed, they must be killed, and then they're ostensibly obliterated. But in fact, they're all kept and they're all filed away and with all the other documents. So they weren't destroyed absolutely. Do you think that was a part of even Stryker? It may have been a sort of Vulgarian sweeping through this, but was part of him, do you think, saying, there may still be a utility, even with these whole faces punched away. There's some value, or I don't know, was it just...
I'm not sure. I think he just kept them because he was so faithful to the job. He had to show that he did the job right. So he killed. That's why we have these documents that say killed, killed, killed. And he kept them together. They were proof of his job. But yeah, it would be nice to interview him if he was alive and see what he thought.
Naya, thank you so much for talking us through this wonderful sounding exhibition. It's called Killed Negatives, Unseen Images of 1930s America. It's on now at the Whitechapel Gallery in London. And it's on until the end of August. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly. Music time now. We'll be hearing from the writer Rob Young in a moment about the story of German musical explorers Can. But first, here they are from back in 1976 with I Want More. Can from Germany there with I Want More. It's just one chapter in the band's varied story, which began in Cologne in the late 1960s and produced over 10 albums and many more soundtracks and one-off projects, guided by an uncompromising spirit of collaboration and experimentation. They've become figureheads for the genre loosely and affectionately known as krautrock.
Writer Rob Young has been documenting the band's story for a new book, All Gates Open, written in collaboration with Can member Ermin Schmidt. Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Rob about it a little earlier. Tom began by asking how to explain a band like Can to a new audience.
Yeah, obviously they chose the name in a pre-Google age. not a very easy one to find. Well, I guess the short answer is they were a German band. They're kind of seen today as the forefront of the krautrock movement, which covers a lot of German bands from the late 60s and early 70s, all of which is pretty influential even today on a lot of musicians. That's one of those bands a lot of people want to be able to sound like. Never quite managed to exactly, but they've certainly been an inspiration for all sorts of people. They formed in 1968. They lasted about 10 years. They made a lot of incredible music, very intense rhythmically, lots of interesting futuristic sounds. That's one way of nutshelling it, I guess.
The book for you begins in 1997 and a visit to the band's studio. This is 20 years of work in a way. I mean, it's 20 years of engagement with the topic at least. You say that Can's influence in the book, you say that it sort of comes around in cycles and it comes in, it comes out, but it always does seem to come back. What is it about their output that you think transcends, you know, brackets, eras or trends?
That is so hard to put my finger on, even now, having spent 4 years researching and writing this book. It's just something about their music that never quite seems to sound out of date. There's a lot of music from the early 70s. You can very clearly, if you heard it, place in that era. And for me, a lot of Can stuff, if you played it blind to somebody who's never heard it, I think they would have a hard time placing it. A lot of it even just sounds totally fresh today. It's something to do with the attitudes between them. It was a kind of utopian project of creating this space for music to emerge through the players, but the players were kind of subjugated to the collective. Nobody really soloed. Everyone took an equal composition credit. It wasn't really vocalist-led. So they kind of took the rock band format and cut it open and turned it inside out in a way. Yeah. And I think maybe that is sort of something to do with the timelessness. They just sort of seemed to combine instruments in interesting ways. They thought quite scientifically about what they did. They moved beyond the kind of rock cliches at every stage. Every new track was an attempt to explore something new.
And I mean, there's a couple of things that you picked up on when you were talking there. I mean, the fact that they weren't very vocals based. They obviously did have some incredible characters as singers, but it was never truly about like a frontman being the center of attention. And I'm quite interested actually in the sort of in the environment that bred a band like Can. There's an excerpt from the book with Ermin Schmidt saying about his upbringing and how these people, a lot of them, their parents were Nazis and they were having to put the past in a box and try and start over and also try and rebuild a very damaged country. Do you think that this kind of band could only have come from Germany, or was there other places in the world where something like this could have arisen?
It certainly have many characteristics that you can locate quite specifically in Germany, I think. One of those is the emphasis on mechanical rhythm and their embrace of technology. Their contemporaries, Kraftwerk, obviously did something similar and took that much further into the charts. But Can were kind of a sort of organic machine, is often the way they refer to themselves. It's some kind of hybrid of a piece of machinery or technology that produced these sounds, but it kind of had organic components, i.e. the players. And they were happy to sort of see themselves in that way. Most of the founders were born just before the Second World War started, which meant that their childhood was very much a passageway through the war, and they were all affected in different ways. Some of them were displaced from their hometowns. Some of them, like you said, had parents who sympathized or directly worked for the Nazi cause. One of them, the drummer, Jackie Lieberseit, had a father that seems to have been disappeared by the Nazi regime for opposing it, but it's not quite clear. That's a generation that ended up being students in the 50s and early 60s, and they were finding that there were people still in positions of responsibility running universities and media empires who had been part of the Nazi regime. And it kind of collided with the late 60s sense of opposition to repressive authorities that they felt kind of empowered to actually start actively engaging with that situation in Germany. I mean, Ermin Schmidt, the keyboardist, always talks about, it's a Germany, is it build something out of the ruins?
Again, it's that thing of it being more about the music than more about maybe a message in a song or the lyrics or anything like that. I mean, they did attract quite pleasingly internationalist lineup at times. You know, Damo Suzuki, he's of sort of Japanese heritage, Malcolm Mooney from the US. How does Can's music find its fans? Because it's not really about latching on to the pivotal lead singer, or it's not really about chart success, certainly, because they also kind of suffered from a slightly anti-German feeling at that time, affecting their success. So, I mean, how did this music find its way to people, and who were they trying to find?
Well, for one thing, I'm not sure they were actively trying to find anybody. They just kind of got together, and they happened to form at a time when major record labels still didn't quite know what the future of rock was going to be. So they were actually happy to invest in anything that seemed interesting or cool. So Can was signed mostly to a major. They had total freedom to produce what they wanted, basically. The strange thing with Can fans is, I mean, even now, you know, when I tell people about what I'm doing with this book, it tends to be two responses. Either no one's ever heard of them, or if people have heard of Can, they really are into Can.
I've not actually really met
someone who knows about Can and doesn't like them.
Yeah.
Which is kind of very unusual in music. So they seem to sort of strike a chord, you know, with a lot of people who hear them. I think, again, it's that sound that they get. And it's, you mentioned internationalism. I mean, they are, you know, the title of the book is All Gates Open.
Yeah.
It's the title of a late Can track, but it really seemed appropriate for this group that just seemed to be kind of open and embracing of a lot of different approaches, a lot of kinds of sound. You know, they not only did the very monotonous rhythmic stuff, they sometimes just put all the instruments down, picked up strange exotic instruments they'd collected from all over the world,
yeah,
and did these kind of, they called them forgeries, ethnic forgeries, and just sort of jammed around with those. They could do sort of abstract, more avant-garde type, ambient type pieces, or they could produce really well-crafted miniature 3-minute pop songs.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they did actually get into the UK charts with the I Want More single in 76.
Yeah,
they were on top of the pops.
Which is as pop and sort
yeah,
of disco banger as it gets.
Yeah, exactly. And there's earlier than that, there was a track called Spoon from 72, which was a big hit in Germany because it was the title track of a popular detective series on TV. You know? So, I mean, they had their feet in all these different worlds.
Mm. I think with any band with a legacy, especially one that maybe just through the sort of cultural dynamics of international boundaries has a bit of mysticism to them, I think a lot of people attach a lot of quite hokey mysteriousness to the process. But they were actually, on one hand, quite seemingly, from when you read about them, quite a, I'm going to use an expletive, shit-hot studio band who just were up for assignments and up for getting things done. And there's that great story in the book about Wim Wenders needing a soundtrack to his film within about 24 hours. And he hears about these people, Can, and he goes up and sees them and sort of, I guess, half begs that he needs something and they knock it out. And he says it was just absolutely perfect and he couldn't have asked for anything better. Are they also just a great pickup band who left the mics on? I mean, what, you know, is it, do people sort of over-romanticise Can, I guess?
I don't think you can over-romanticise them. I think the great thing is that no matter how much you sort of expose the practicalities of this group, somehow the magic seems to be there all the more, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, yeah, that particular thing with Wenders, they were just knocking off after a day in the studio, probably absolutely exhausted. But then they kind of just about to go home, you know, this guy turns up and they did manage to create a really, it was Alice in the Cities, the film in question. Great soundtrack. They were a mixture of sort of pros and amateurs, you could say. I mean, three of them had been professional musicians in the 60s. Ermin Schmidt was a great classical pianist and conductor of orchestras. Jackie Liebeseit, the drummer, had been playing in jazz groups quite successfully in Germany all through the 60s as well. You know, yeah. So these were, yeah, they were extremely competent musicians.
There was a lot of people like Jackie Liebeseit. I mean, although he is rapidly ascending up the sort of almost like John Bonham ladder of being regarded as, you know, one of the great Styxmen. I love that drummers call it a throne. That's the most like funnily arrogant term in drumming. He was also working to a lot of quite sort of interesting philosophical and intellectual processes when he drummed as well. It wasn't just about being like a monster on the kit. There was a lot of like analytical thinking in the band as well as being a practical studio outfit.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it takes incredible discipline to do what they did. And he was possibly the most disciplined of the lot. Yeah, he had some kind of theory or system. It's something to do with Morse code, the dot and the dash, and how you combine those. And he was very interested in almost like the how to get back to the sort of absolute primal human rhythm, you know, what would sort of cavemen have been playing on logs, you know.
And yeah.
So it's a fantastic thing about Can. It's like this sort of, there's this primeval heart to it, but at the same time it embraces modern technology and recording skill as well. So
I always return to that quote about, I can't remember who in the band said it, but that thing of the band being played by the music. Do you know what I mean? This thing of slightly surrendering to, well, what many people call the motoric rhythm, or some people call it krautrock, but this thing of surrendering yourself to a sort of slightly greater force. I mean, that is a quality that you can throw over so many moments and areas in music. But for you, where do you see their influence like pinpointed most acutely?
I mean, you know, it's a bit crass to sort of just list a bunch of artists, but I mean, I can do that, that there's a kind of line you can draw. I mean, even people there at the time of Can, friends of theirs, they were great friends with Hawkwind at the time and Roxy Music. And I think sometimes you can, I've been listening to some Roxy recently from that period, and I think they picked up on rhythmically some of that pounding force of some of Can's music. Even in the punk era, I mean, the interesting thing about Can is, you know, when punk kicked out a lot of progressive music, you know, the I Hate Pink Floyd t-shirt worn by John Lydon, it was Lydon himself who actually bigged up Can, you know, as a big influence. And he was sort of a very public image limited, is definitely, you can draw a line there. And also Pete Shelley of the Buzzcocks was a huge Can fan and even wrote some sleeve notes for them in the mid-70s. I mean, they split up in 78. So the 80s was a sort of slightly sort of invisible time for Can, but they all went off doing quite interesting solo projects. I mean, Holger Shukai did some great work with David Sylvian on his solo albums. That's the first time I really heard anyone from Can was probably on David Sylvian albums in the early 80s. I think their methods, I mean, especially the tape editing that Holger was doing, you know, started to kind of filter into the early days of sampling. You know, he did some amazing records in the late 70s, right after Can finished, where he was kind of splicing what you could call samples together on tape,
yeah,
and kind of making these collage-y type pieces of music. And, you know, you start to see that whether or not people were hearing what he was doing later or not is impossible to say, but certainly you can hear pre-echoes of what hip-hop type producers were doing later on. And people are, you know, now, I mean, Kanye West sampled this song, Sing Swan Song by Can, not so long ago. So, I mean, you know, people are taking notice.
I've just had the absolutely atrocious brainwave of surely there must be a sort of Jay-Z White Album, Grey Album, Kanye album that you can yes. get. That must be possible.
Someone needs to do that.
Yeah, there's so many amazing beats from Can. Do you know what I mean? That really should happen. Yeah. But I interrupted your train of thought.
No,
but
I mean, Radiohead and Johnny Greenwood have been quite vocal in saying how much Can have meant to them. And they've covered this Can song called Thief on stage sometimes. And some of Johnny Greenwood's soundtracks has involved also picking Can songs. You still hear them cropping up on soundtracks now. I mean, the Ben Wheatley High Rise movie from a couple of years ago featured some Can songs on the soundtrack, you know. So they're still there. It was one of these sort of holy canon of interesting experimental music. They're kind of an aspirational band for a lot of other groups.
It's a state of mind.
Yeah.
Also, I've just remembered the OCs, they have a song called Contraption / Soul Desert, because the end of it borrows that sort of Soul Desert refrain from one of those Can songs. So anyway, lots of places you can spot their influence. The book is All Gates Open. It's by Rob Young, and I recommend anyone wanting to know anything about not necessarily just Can, but just an interesting band who don't quite always get in the spotlight. I think it's well worth a read for anyone with a slightly deeper interest in music. So thank you very much, Rob.
Thanks, Tom.
Rob Young there, speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Michel Hazanavicius is the cinematic mind behind The Artist, which won him Best Director, of course, at the Oscars in 2011. He's now back with a comedy-drama redoubtable known as Godard Mon Amour in the US, based on the life of Jean-Luc Godard, drawing material from the writer and actress Anne Wiesemski, who's also Godard's former wife. Rob spoke to Michel earlier to learn about the new film and Godard's career.
Il était respecté dans le monde entier. La nouvelle vague, c'était lui, Jean-Luc Godard.
Monsieur et Madame Nou ont eu une fille, ils l'ont appelée Marion.
Marion Nou ?
Oui, mon amour. Marion Nou.
J'avais cette chance d'admirer l'homme que j'aimais.
Michel, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly today. Congratulations on Godard Mon Amour.
Thank you.
Obviously, Jean-Luc Godard is a god in French cinema. You get butterflies in your stomach when you make a movie about a kind of living god.
Well, not that much, I have to say, because he's a god in the international cinephile, of course, in France, but also in America, in a lot of countries. But I'm not part of the sect, I would say. He's not a god for me. He's not a hero.
You've got reasonable doubts, possibly.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, no, I'm a huge fan of the first decade. The early works for me is like really creative, innovative, charming, and full of invention. And I really love their movies. And then since, I would say, the 70s, reasonable doubts is a good statement.
It's a good statement about any religion, Godard or otherwise, right? And how do you go about, I mean, obviously this came from a book written by Anne, his ex-wife. What's the tone of that book? Because it's an interesting one, turning a memoir into a film.
I really love the way she portrayed Godard and also the period, late 60s in France. And it was kind of nostalgic in a way, but she was maybe 60-something when she wrote the book, but she really respected the young lady she was when she was in love with Jean-Luc Godard. So the book is not as naive as she was, But it's not like there's no cynicism. She really respected her eyes of love, I would say. So it was a very touching and funny tone. I made the movie maybe funnier than the book was. I tried to really make her...
Thank you.
I mean, Godard can be very funny. Sometimes he knows he's funny, sometimes he doesn't. But, I mean, I wanted to make a comedy. And actually, that's how I convinced Anne to accept to sell the rights for an adaptation.
That's a nice thing, because, as you said, Godard is often used with kid gloves. He's regarded as something other, you know, as someone untouchable in cinema.
Yeah.
And there is something knockabout with this. It looks at the narcissism of Jean-Luc Godard as much as his genius and all the rest of it. Despite the fact you were working, I suppose, with Anne, in a sense, on this project, or certainly off the back of her book, how even-handed did you have to be with Godard himself?
Well, it was all a question of balance for everything. I mean, the guy, I was about to say the man, the great man, is full of paradoxes.
Guy's all right, yeah. The guy, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's full of contradiction. I wanted to be very fair with the negative thing and the positive things. I mean, he was a genius at these times, but he was also a very difficult man, and he could act really like, can I say bad words here?
You can.
Yeah, so he could act as an asshole, and I portrayed him like this, and there's a quote of Ernst Lubitsch that I love, which he says, my theory is that every great man is ridiculous at least twice a day. And that was the path I followed to portray Godard, actually. I worked on this too ridiculous part of the day.
And the film, it looks so beautiful, that it's so sumptuous. There's something about the grading of the film, either using original film or the fact that that's been done post-shooting, I suppose, in post-production. Were there Godard films that you were referring to in the colour, the costumes that people were wearing? Because it seems in so many places like a real kind of cross-section, 1968 and the years surrounding it.
It's a mix of all his early works, the one of the first decade, but especially, of course, the color movies. So you can recognize like motifs of his work from The Contempt or from Pierrot le Fou or from these movies. And I tried to make it like playful. It was very joyful for me to work with these motifs because, as I said before, I mean, these movies were full of invention. The main word would be freedom. He made very freely all these movies. I tried to use that freedom to put some distance in the movie and to work on that distance more or less in a comedy style.
It feels relaxed. It feels easy. It feels... I tell you what it feels like. You know how people say they wear their learning lightly? That phrase
exactly,
in English.
Yeah.
And it's a bit, little bit like that. You can know a lot, but you can kind of do it with ease. It's kind of a nice thing.
Yeah, exactly. I like this concept of easy watching.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like easy listening, but for movies.
Yeah.
And you can make an easy watching movie and being not that superficial. You can deal with deep topics and you can respect the characters and respect the story and tell a real story, but in a cool way. I mean, you can make fun and you can make like jokes and everything. I mean, many directors have done this.
Tell me about some of the politics of the era, 1968. There's so many books about it because of the anniversary. What's your feeling as a French filmmaker making film at that time? Is that, again, something a little bit like the legacy of Godard, something that you have to kind of, you have to worry a little bit about the politics of it? Or can you make something that's kind of funny and lighthearted set around 1968?
Well, I think the movie respects a lot May 68. I mean, I don't really make fun about the students or May 68.
Because there are bits of that that are clearly funny as well.
Yeah, right? But the funny thing is that Jean-Luc Godard was 40 in 68, so he was not in sync with the students. He was the funny guy, but the literal thing is with May 68. I mean, I'm very serious in a way, the way I portray May 68. I really adore them. I really love May 68. It was like really a fresh breed of freedom, and they really changed the society for a better society. I really respect them, and I like the way they thought about the revolution. You wanted to make the revolution with these guys. They were sexy and they were funny, and you could believe that in a new society. When I look at people who are claiming for a revolution now, I mean, in France, they are not that sexy. You don't want to make a new society with them. They're way too serious for me.
Yeah. You're making a film about the right era of dissent.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because at the time, Godard was trying to be in with the in crowd, a great creative maestro, but didn't quite have the vibe of these young protesters, the students, and the passion and sexiness. And you're very funny in the film with this, sort of trying to show the kind of, I suppose, the difference between his how he thought he looked and how he actually looked at that time.
Yeah, I think it was very abrupt for him. Mm-hmm. He was born in 1930. And so when he was a kid, he was literally, he said that, he was following the moves of the German army on a map of Europe with small Nazis flags, really. Mm-hmm. So in May 68, the kids who did the revolution, the riots in France, were born in 46 or 48. They were the first baby boomers. So they were, May 68 was like the official end of the post-war era. So he was not in sync with these guys. He used to be, during all the 60s, like the young director. We used to call him the Young Turks in France. And suddenly, like, but in a week, he was old. And I think it was very, very difficult for him. Very difficult. Because you don't go from young to old in 1 week, usually. It takes time to realize.
We've all had weeks like that, Michelle. Come
no,
on.
No, of course, but it takes time to realize that you're old. Believe me, I'm 51. I know what I'm talking about.
And when it comes to casting something like this, these are such magical characters. And obviously writ large into French cinema, in reality, now you're doing it in fiction kind of thing. How did you go about that? I mean, I know some of the casts you've obviously worked with before, but did you have a kind of wish list, or did you workshop this movie? How did you cast it?
I wanted to work with Louis Garrel.
Mm, he's great, right? I mean,
he's great.
This is a tough job, very well done.
Yeah, and you know, you can't expect more than an actor than what he did. I mean, he worships Godard, really. So he really defended his character. And that's exactly what you want from an actor, to defend the character and to make it like human. And he wanted people to love him. And I wanted people to make fun of him. So it was like...
So you're not on good terms with Louis anymore, but...
No, I don't know. We're friends. It's okay. But no, it was kind of a... Not a conflict, but different point of views on the character. And I think that was good for the character itself. So he's like a hero of the French New Wave. His father is a very respected director, Philippe Garrel. He's supposed to be, the last of the French New Wave, maybe. There's something a little bit maybe pervert of the way I used him. There's kind of a meta thing about casting him. And the actress, she's great, Stacey Martin. She lives in London, by the way. She's half French, half English. She's great. She's a wonderful actress. It was a more traditional casting. I wrote the part and I looked for an actress, and she came after maybe 1 week of casting. And when she came and when she did a test, it was done. I mean, she was so obvious. She's a great actress. She's a very nice person to work with.
Yeah. And did the cast, yourself and the cast, when they're dealing with characters that are still living, what does that do to the way, are people slightly walking on eggshells? They're a little bit nervous? Or can you wholeheartedly give yourself to this?
I don't really care about that. I mean, it's fiction. First, Godard himself... A lot of people know him, so we know exactly how he looks, how he speaks. We had to, when we worked with Louis at first, he wanted to do it like this, not mimicking the voice, not even his appearance. He wanted to have his own look, and so I had to push him a little bit to convince him that the audience would need like the few signals that they were looking at Jean-Luc Godard, not Louis Garrel. Because he's very well known, but all the other characters are not that famous. So the audience, we don't care. What I did, for example, in the book, there's a wonderful sequence with the Beatles, with François Truffaut, with a lot of well-known people. But I didn't put them into the movie because I'm always embarrassed when I see, like, You know, there's an actor that comes in the frame and says, "Hey, oh, that's Ringo Starr. How are you, Ringo Starr? Oh, Paul McCartney." It's stupid. I mean, nobody can believe that. So that's not in the movie.
Well, thanks for sparing us that. And just finally, obviously, people will obviously know and love your work and have known and loved the artist as well. Making films about film itself, is there a sort of starting point for you? Is it watching something and getting getting just 30 seconds of perfect footage and kind of using that as the model for a film? Or what's your stepping off point when you're making a movie about the movies?
Well, it's more that it gives me maybe the opportunity to work on the form of cinema itself. And when I talk about Godard, I play with the form of my movie, playing with his motives. So it's kind of meta things, and I can make a joke. I don't know, there's something which is very playful for me, because it's not just about telling a story or telling characters, it's also talking about the form of cinema and playing with that language, which is so specific. And I like when I go to the movies to have something more in the form of the movie. And I'm not sure that I could invent a new form of cinema like maybe Terrence Malick could do, but I can play with it, and it's okay for me. I mean, I like it. It's fun, and it gives you something to think about the language of cinema. I kind of like it.
Yeah, we like it too. Yeah. It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
And just finally, we should say this is Godard Mon Amour in France, of course. It's called Redoubtable in the US and in the UK. That's a quote, that was some sort of joke that Godard had with Anne. Where does that come from, that other title?
Redoubtable.
Yeah.
It's Redoubtable in France and Godard Mon Amour in the US.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, Redoubtable is it's the name of a submarine. In France, it's not a pun, but it's like a double meaning word. Someone who's redoubtable is someone like is really good. Also, someone you're a little bit fear.
Like a nuclear submarine, you might have misgivings
exactly.
About. Okay.
And there's also something that can have an echo with Godard himself. I mean, he's kind of a submarine. I mean, he you don't see him like for 10 years and suddenly come back with a new movie and. And he makes movies since 50 years now. No, 60 years now. So, yeah, you can compare him to a submarine, I guess.
The Redoubtable Michel, thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Michel Hasnovicius talking to Rob there. Redoubtable, known as Godard Mon Amour, stateside, is out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
That was edition 463 of the Monocle Weekly, Tom. It flew past like a kingfisher that you spy on a riverside and wonder if you've even seen it at all. But no, it was a thing of great beauty.
I feel, Rob, I may have almost overeaten. There was so much cultural sustenance.
Yeah.
I'm feeling a bit portly.
Thanks, of course, to Cassie Galpin and our producer, Tom Hall. And the Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. And for the time being, from me, Robert Bowne.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.